forward to you, inviting, bewitching, come hither, squid. Although my mother would return soon from her errand, and while at any moment a neighbor might have walked by the lean-to of our kitchen and caught me with my cephalopodic bride, I nevertheless dropped my trousers. Hypnotized by my squid's call and my erection's response, I inserted the latter into the former, which was, unfortunately, a perfect fit. Unfortunate because from then onward no squid was safe from me. Not to say that this diluted form of bestiality, after all, hapless squid, you were dead. Although now I see how that raises other moral questions. Not to say this transgression occurred often, since squid was a rare treat in our landlocked town. My father had given my mother the squid as a gift, as he himself ate well. Priests always had much attention lavished on them by their star-struck fans. Those devout housewives and wealthy congregants who treated them as if they were guardians of the velvet rope blocking entrance into that ever-so-exclusive nightclub, Heaven. These fans invited them to dinner, cleaned their chambers, cooked their food, and bribed them with gifts of various kinds, including delectable, expensive seafood not meant for the likes of a poor woman like my mother. While I felt no shame at all for my shuddering ejaculation, an enormous burden of guilt fell on me as soon as my senses returned, not because of any moral violation, but because I could hardly bear depriving my mother of even a morsel of squid. We had only a half dozen, and she would notice one missing. What to do? What to do? A plan instantly came to my devious mind as I stood with the befuddled, deflowered squid in hand, my blasphemy leaking from its molested vulva. First, rinse the evidence of crime from the inert, abused squid. Second, cut shallow scars onto the skin to identify the victim squid. Then wait for dinner. My innocent mother returned to our miserable hut, stuffed the squid with ground pork, bean thread noodle, diced mushroom and chopped ginger, then fried and served them with a ginger-lime dipping sauce. There, on the plate, reclined my beloved, forlorn odalisque, marked by my hand, and when my mother said to help myself, I seized it instantly with my chopstick to forestall any chance of my mother doing so. I paused, my mother's expectant, loving eyes upon me, and then I dipped the squid into the ginger-lime sauce and took the first bite. "Well," she said, "delicious," I stammered. "Good, but you should chew it rather than swallow it whole, son. Take your time, it will taste better that way." "Yes, Mama," I said, and bravely smiling, this obedient son slowly chewed and savored the rest of his defiled squid, its salty flavor mixed with his mother's sweet love. Some will undoubtedly find this episode obscene, not I. Massacre is obscene, torture is obscene, 3 million dead is obscene. Masturbation, even with an admittedly non-consensual squid, not so much. I, for one, am a person who believes that the world would be a better place if the word murder made us mumble as much as the word masturbation. Still, while I was more lover than fighter, my political choices and police service eventually did force me to cultivate a side of myself I had used only once in my childhood, the violent side. Even as a secret policeman, however, I never used violence in so much as I allowed others to use it in front of me. Only when unfavorable conditions squeezed me into situations from which my cleverness could not extract me did I permit this violence to happen. These situations were so unpleasant that the memories of those whom I had seen interrogated continued to hijack me with fanatic persistance. The wiry Montagnard with a wire twisted around his neck and a twisted grimace on his face. The stubborn terrorist in his white room with his purple face, impervious to everything except the one thing. The communist agent with the papier-mâché evidence of her espionage crammed into her mouth, our sour names literally on the tip of her tongue. These captured subversives had only one destination, but there were many unpleasant side roads to get there. When I arrived at the liquor store for the grand opening, I shared with these prisoners the dread uncertainty that snickered beneath the card tables of retirement homes. Someone was going to die. perhaps me. The liquor store was on the eastern end of Hollywood Boulevard, far from the camera-popping glamour of the Egyptian and Chinese theaters where the latest movies premiered. This particularly unfashionable neighborhood was a shady one, despite the absence of trees, and Bond's other function, besides clerking, was to intimidate any would-be robbers and shoplifters. He nodded at me impassively from the cash register, standing before a wall of shelves displaying Primo brands, theft-worthy pint bottles, and, in a discreet corner, men's magazines with airbrushed Lolitas on their covers. "Claude's in the storeroom with the general," Bond said. The storeroom was in the back, abuzz with overhead fluorescent lights, smelling of disinfectant and old cardboard. Claude rose from his vinyl chair and we embraced. He was heavier by a few pounds, but otherwise unchanged, even wearing a rumpled sport jacket he used on occasion in Saigon. "Have a seat," the general said from behind his desk. The vinyl chairs squeaked obscenely when we moved. Cartons and crates hemmed us in on three sides. The general's desk was cluttered with a rotary dial phone heavy enough for self-defense, a stamp pad bleeding red ink, a receipt book with a blue sheet of carbon paper tucked between the pages, and a desk lamp with a broken neck, its head refusing to stay raised. When the general opened his desk drawer, my heart choked. Here it was, the moment when the rat would get a hammer to the head, a knife to the neck, a bullet in the temple, or possibly all of the above just for the fun of it. At least it would be quick, relatively speaking. Back in the European Dark Ages, according to the interrogation course that Claude had taught to the secret policeman in Saigon, I would have been drawn and quartered by horses, my head stuck on a pole for all to see. One royal humorist flayed his enemy alive and then stuffed the skin with straw, mounted it on a horse, and paraded it around town. What a laugh! I stopped breathing and waited for the general to pull out the pistol with which he was going to remove my brains in an unsurgical fashion. But all he extracted was a bottle of scotch and a pack of cigarettes. "Well," said Claude, "I wish we were reuniting in better circumstances, gentlemen. I heard you had a hell of a time getting out of Dodge." "That," the general said, "is putting it mildly." "And yourself?" I said. "I bet you got out on the last helicopter." "Well, let's not be too dramatic," Claude said. He accepted the general's offer of a cigarette and a tumbler of scotch. "I got out a few hours earlier on the ambassador's helicopter," he sighed. "I am never going to forget that day. We waited too damn long to get our act together. You were the last ones out on airplanes. The Marines flew in on helicopters to get the rest of the people from the airport and the embassy. Air America was flying rescue choppers, too. But the problem was that everyone in town knew about our supposedly secret helipads. Turns out that we'd enlisted little Vietnamese ladies to paint those helipad numbers on the roof. Smart, huh? Come the moment of truth, all those buildings were surrounded. The ones who were supposed to get to the helicopters couldn't get to them. Same story at the airport. No way in. The docks, totally impassable. Even the buses going to the embassy couldn't get in, since the embassy was mobbed by thousands. They were having all kinds of papers. Marriage certificates, employment contracts, letters, even U.S. passports. They were screaming, "I know so-and-so. So-and-so can vouch for me. I'm married to a U.S. citizen." None of that counted. The Marines were on the wall and pounding anybody who tried to come up. You had to get close enough to give a Marine $1,000 before he'd haul you up. We go up to the wall or to the gate every now and then and look for the people who worked for us, and we'd point them out. If they got close, the Marines yanked them up or opened the gates a bit to just let that person in. But sometimes we'd see people we knew in the middle of the crowd or on the fringes, and we'd wave at them to get to the wall, but they couldn't. All those Vietnamese in front weren't letting any Vietnamese in back get ahead. So we'd look and wave, and they'd look and wave, and then after a while we just looked away and left. Thank God I couldn't hear them screaming, not over all that ruckus. I'd go back inside and have a drink, but it wasn't any better. You should have heard the radio chatter. "Help me. I'm a translator. We have 70 translators at this address. Get us out. Help me. We have 500 people at this compound. Get us out. Help me. We have 200 at logistics. Get us out. Help me. We have 100 at the CIA hotel. Get us out." Guess what? None of those people got out. We told them to go to those places and wait for us. We had guys at those places, and we called them and said, "No one's coming. Get yourselves out now and get to the embassy. Leave those people behind." Then there were the people outside the city. Agents all over the countryside were calling in. "Help, I'm in Kanto. The VC are closing in. Help, you left me in the Yumin forest. What am I going to do? What about my family? Help me get out of here." They had no chance in hell. Even some of those in the embassy had no chance. We evacuated thousands, but when the last helicopter took off, there were still 400 people waiting in the courtyard, all neatly arranged and waiting for the helicopters we told them were still coming. None of them got out. Christ, I need another drink even to talk about this. Thank you, General. He rubbed his eyes. All I can say is it was personal. After I left you at the airport, I went back to my villa to get some sleep. I told Kim to meet me at dawn. She was going to get her family. 6 comes along, 6:15, 6:37. The chief calls me up and wants to know where I am. I put him off. 7:15, 7:30, 8. The chief calls me back and says, "Get your ass down to the embassy now, every man on deck." The hell with the chief, that Hungarian bastard. I grab my guns and drive across town to find Kim. Forget the daytime curfew. Everyone was out and running around, trying to find a way out. Suburbs were quieter, though. Life was normal. I even saw Kim's neighbors breaking out the commie flag. The previous week, those same people were flying your flag. I asked them where she was. They said they didn't know where the Yankee whore was. I wanted to shoot them then and there, but everybody on the street had turned out to look at me. I sure couldn't wait for the local Viet Cong to come kidnap me. I drove back to the villa, 10 o'clock. She wasn't there. I couldn't wait any longer. I sat in the car, and I cried. I haven't cried over a girl in 30 years, but hell, there you have it. Then I drove to the embassy and saw there was no way in. Like I said, thousands of people. I left the keys in the ignition just like you did, General, and I hope some communist son of a bitch is enjoying himself with my Bel Air. Then I fought my way through the crowd. Those Vietnamese who wouldn't let their own fellow Vietnamese through, they made way for me. Sure, I pushed and shoved and screamed, and plenty of them pushed and shoved and screamed right back. But I got closer, even though the closer I got, the tougher it was. I had made eye contact with the Marines on the wall, and I knew if I could just get close enough, I'd be saved. I was sweating like a pig, my shirt was torn, and all those bodies were packed against me. The people in front of me couldn't see I was an American, and no one was turning around just because I was tapping them on the shoulder. So I yanked them by the hair, or pulled them by the ear, or grabbed them by the shirt collar to haul them out of my way. I'd never done anything like that in my life. I was too proud to scream at first, but it didn't take long before I was screaming too. "Let me through! I'm an American, goddammit!" I finally got myself to that wall, and when those Marines reached down and grabbed my hand and pulled me up, I damn near cried again. Claude finished the last of his drink and banged the glass on the desk. I was never so ashamed in my life, but I was also never so goddamn glad to be an American either. We sat in silence while the general poured us each another double. "Here's to you, Claude," I said, raising my glass to him. "Congratulations." "For what?" he said, raising his own. "Now you know what it feels like to be one of us." His laugh was short and bitter. I was thinking the exact same thing. The cue for the evacuation's final phase was "White Christmas," played on American radio service. But even this did not go according to plan. First, since the song was top-secret information meant only for the Americans and their allies, everyone in the city also knew what to listen for. "Then what do you think happens?" Claude said. "The DJ can't find the song, the Bing Crosby one. He's tossing his booth looking for that tape, and of course it's not there. Then what?" said the general. "He finds a version by Tennessee Ernie Ford and plays that." "Who's he?" I said. "How do I know? At least the melody and lyrics were the same." "So," I said, "situation normal." Claude nodded. "All fucked up. Let's just hope history forgets the snafu." This was the prayer many a general and politician said before they went to bed, but some snafus were more justifiable than others. Take the operation's name, Frequent Wind, a snafu foreshadowing a snafu. I had brooded on it for a year, wondering if I could sue the U.S. government for malpractice, or at least a criminal failure of the literary imagination. Who was the military mastermind who squeezed out frequent win from between his tightly clenched buttocks? Didn't it occur to anyone that frequent win might bring to mind the divine win that inspired the kamikaze, or more likely, for the ahistorical juvenile set, the phenomenon of passing gas, which, as is well known, can lead to a chain reaction, hence the frequency? Or was I not giving the military mastermind enough credit for being a deadpan ironist, he having also possibly chosen White Christmas as a poke in the eye to all my countrymen who neither celebrated Christmas nor had ever seen a white one? Could not this unknown ironist foresee that all the bad air whipped up by American helicopters was the equivalent of a massive blast of gas in the faces of those left behind? Weighing stupidity and irony, I picked the latter, irony lending the Americans a last shred of dignity. It was the only thing salvageable from the tragedy that had befallen us, or that we had brought on ourselves, depending on one's point of view. The problem with this tragedy is that it had not ended neatly, unlike a comedy. It still preoccupied us, the general most of all, who now turned to business. "I am glad you are here, Claude. Your timing could not be more perfect." Claude shrugged. "Timing's one thing I've always been good at, General. We have a problem, as you warned me before we left." "Which problem? There was more than one, as I recall." "We have an informer, a spy." Both looked at me, as if for confirmation. I kept my face impassive, even as my stomach began to rotate counterclockwise. When the general named a name, it was the crapulent major's. My stomach began to rotate in the opposite direction. "I don't know that guy," Claude said. "He is not a man to be known. He is not a remarkable officer. It is our young friend here who chose to bring the major with us. If you remember, sir, the major..." "It hardly matters. What matters is that I was tired, and I made a mistake by giving you that job. I do not blame you. I blame myself. Now it is time to correct a mistake." "Why do you think it's this guy?" "Number one, he is Chinese. Number two, my contacts in Saigon say his family is doing very, very well. Number three, he is fat. I do not like fat men." "Just because he's Chinese doesn't mean he's a spy, General." "I am not a racist, Claude. I treat all my men the same, no matter their origins, like our young friend here. But this major, the fact that his family is doing well in Saigon is suspicious. Why are they doing well? Who allows them to prosper? The communists know all our officers and their families. No officer's family is doing well at home. Why his?"
"Circumstantial evidence, General."
"That never stopped you before, Claude. Things are different here. You have to play by new rules." "But I can bend the rules, can I not?"
"You can even break them if you know how."
I tabulated things learned. First, I had scored a coup, much to my chagrin and purely by accident, throwing the blame onto a blameless man. Second, the general had contacts in Saigon, meaning some kind of resistance existed. Third, the general could contact his people, though no direct communication was available. Fourth, the general was fully his old self again, a perennial plotter with at least one scheme in each pocket and another in his sock. Waving his arms to indicate our surroundings, he said, "Do I look like a small business owner to you gentlemen? Do I look like I enjoy selling liquor to drunks and blacks and Mexicans and the homeless and addicts? Let me tell you something. I am just biding my time. This war is not over. Those communist bastards, all right, they hurt us badly, we admit that. But I know my people, I know my soldiers, my men. They haven't given up. They are willing to fight and die if they get the chance. That's all we need, Claude, a chance."
"Bravo, General," said Claude. "I knew you wouldn't stay down for long."
"I am with you, sir," I said, "to the end." "Good. Because you picked the major, do you agree that you must correct your mistake?"
"I thought you would."
"You do not have to do it alone. I have already discussed the problem of the major with Bonn. You two will take care of this problem together. I leave it up to your endless imagination and skill to figure out the solution. You have never disappointed me before, except in picking the major. Now you can redeem yourself. Understood? Good. Now leave us. Claude and I have business to discuss. The store was empty except for Bon, watching the phosphorescent hypnotic signal of a baseball game on a tiny black-and-white television by the cash register. I cashed a check in my pocket, my tax refund from the IRS. It was not a large sum, and yet symbolically significant, for never in my country would the midget-minded government give back to its frustrated citizens anything it had seized in the first place. The whole idea was absurd. Our society had been a kleptocracy of the highest order, the government doing its best to steal from the Americans, the average man doing his best to steal from the government, and the worst of us doing our best to steal from each other. Now, despite my sense of fellow feeling for my exiled countrymen, I could not also help but feel that our country was being born again. The accretions of foreign corruption cleansed by revolutionary flames. Instead of tax refunds, the revolution would redistribute ill-gotten wealth, following the philosophy of more to the people. What the people did with their socialist sugar was up to them. As for me, I used my capitalist refund to buy enough booze to keep Bon and me uneasily steeped in amnesia until next week, which, if not foresightful, was nevertheless my choice, choice being my sacred American right. "The Major," I said as Bon bagged the bottles, "you really think he's a spy?"
"What do I know about it? I'm just a grunt."
"You do as you're told." "So do you, smart guy. Since you're so smart, you planned this. You know your way around here better than me. But the dirty stuff you leave to me. Now come and take a look." Behind the counter was a sawed-off, double-barreled shotgun on a rack beneath the cash register. "Like it?"
"How did you get that?"
"Easier to get a gun here than to vote or drive. You don't even need to know English. Funny thing is, the Major got us the connection. He speaks Chinese. Chinese gangs are all over Chinatown. It's going to be messy with a shotgun."
"We're not using a shotgun, genius."
He opened a cigar box resting on a shelf beneath the counter. Inside was a .38 Special, a revolver with a snub nose, identical to the one I carried as my service pistol.
"Delicate enough for you?"
Once again, I was trapped by circumstances, and once again, I would soon see another man trapped by circumstances. The only compensation for my sadness was the expression on Bond's face. It was the first time he had looked happy in a year. Chapter 6 The grand opening began later that afternoon, the general shaking hands with well-wishers while chatting easily and smiling incessantly. Like a shark who must keep swimming to live, a politician, which was what the general had become, had to keep his lips constantly moving. The constituents, in this case, were old colleagues, followers, soldiers, and friends. A platoon of 30 or so middle-aged men whom I had rarely encountered without their uniforms, until our time in the refugee camps on Guam. Seeing them again in Mufti, a year later, confirmed the verdict of defeat, and showed these men now to be guilty of numerous sartorial misdemeanors. They squeaked around the store in bargain basement penny loafers and creased budget khakis, or in ill-fitting suits advertised by wholesalers for the price of buy one, get one free. Ties, handkerchiefs, and socks were thrown in, though what was really needed was cologne, even of the gigolo kind. Anything to mask the olfactory evidence of their having been gleefully skunked by history. As for me, even though I was of a lesser rank than most of these men, I was better dressed, thanks to Professor Hammer's hand-me-downs. With just a bit of tailoring, his blue blazer with gold buttons and his gray flannel sacks fit me perfectly. Thus, smartly dressed, I made my way through the men, all of whom I knew in my capacity as the general's aide. Many once commanded artillery batteries and infantry battalions, but now they possess nothing more dangerous than their pride, their halitosis, and their car keys, if they even own cars. I had reported all the gossip about these vanquished soldiers to Paris, and knew what they did, or in many cases did not do, for a living. Most successful was a general infamous for using his crack troops to harvest cinnamon, whose circulation he monopolized. Now the spice merchant lorded over a pizza parlor. One colonel, an asthmatic quartermaster who became unreasonably excited discussing dehydrated rations, was a janitor. A dashing major who flew gunships, now a mechanic. A grizzled captain with a talent for hunting gorillas, short order cook. An effectless lieutenant, sole survivor of an ambush company. Delivery man. So the list went on. A fair percentage collecting both welfare and dust, moldering in the stale air of subsidized apartments, as their testes shriveled day by day, consumed by the metastasizing cancer called assimilation, and susceptible to the hypochondria of exile. In this psychosomatic condition, normal social or familial ills were diagnosed as symptoms of something fatal, with their vulnerable women and children cast as the carriers of Western contamination. Their afflicted kids were talking back, not in their native language, but in a foreign tongue they were mastering faster than their fathers. As for the wives, most had been forced to find jobs, and in doing so, had been transformed from the winsome lotuses the men remembered them to be. As the crapulent major said, "A man doesn't need balls in this country, Captain. The women all have their own." True, I concurred, though I suspected nostalgia had brainwashed the major and the others. Their memories had been laundered so thoroughly as to be colored differently from mine, for never had they talked so fondly about their wives in Vietnam. "Have you ever thought about moving, Major? Maybe you and your wife could get a fresh start and rekindle your romance, get away from all the reminders of your past." "But what would I do for food?" he said in all seriousness. "The Chinese food is best where we live." I reached forth to straighten his crooked tie, with matched crooked teeth. "All right, Major, then let me take you out. You can show me where the good Chinese food is." "My pleasure," the crapulent major beamed. He was a bon vivant who loved food and friendship, someone without an enemy in his new world, except for the general. Why had I mentioned the crapulent major's name to him? Why hadn't I given the name of someone whose sins outweighed his flesh, rather than this man whose flesh outweighed his sins? Leaving the major behind, I made my way through the crowd to the general. I was ready for some political boosterism, even of the most calculated kind. He was standing by Madame, next to the Chardonnay and Cabernet, being interviewed by a man waving a microphone between the two of them as if it were a Geiger counter. I caught her eye, and when she amplified the wattage of her smile, the man turned around, a camera hanging around his neck, and a retractable pen with four colors of ink peeking from his shirt pocket. It took a moment for the recognition to register. I had last seen Son Do, or Sonny, as he was nicknamed, in 1969, my final year in America. He was likewise a scholarship student at a college in Orange County, an hour away by car. It was the birthplace of the war criminal Richard Nixon, as well as the home of John Wayne, a place so ferociously patriotic I thought Agent Orange might have been manufactured there, or at least named in its honor. Sonny's subject of study was journalism, which would have been useful for our country if Sonny's particular brand were not so subversive. He carried a baseball bat of integrity on his shoulder, ready to clobber the fat softballs of his opponent's inconsistencies. Back then, he had been self-confidence, or arrogance, depending on your point of view, a legacy of his aristocratic heritage. His grandfather was a Mandarin, as he never ceased reminding you. This grandfather inveighed against the French with such volume and acidity that they shipped him on a one-way berth to Tahiti, where, after supposedly befriending a syphilitic Gauguin, he succumbed to either dengue fever or an incurable strain of virulent homesickness. Sonny inherited the utter sense of conviction that motivated his honorable grandfather, who I am sure was insufferable, as most men of utter conviction are. Like a hardcore conservative, Sonny was right about everything, or thought himself so, the key difference being that he was a naked leftist. He led the anti-war faction of Vietnamese foreign students, a handful of whom assembled monthly, at a sterile room in the student union, or in someone's apartment, passions running hot and food getting cold. I attended these parties as well as the ones thrown by the equally compact pro-war gang, differing in political tone but otherwise totally interchangeable in terms of food eaten, songs sung,
jokes traded, and topics discussed. Regardless of political clique, these students gulp from the same overflowing cup of loneliness, drawing together for comfort like these ex-officers in the liquor store, hoping for the body heat of fellow sufferers in an exile so chilly even the California sun could not warm their cold feet. "I heard you were here too," Sunny said, gripping my hand and unwrapping a genuine smile. The confidence I remembered so well radiated from his eyes, rendering his ascetic face with its antiseptic lips attractive. "It's great to see you again, old friend." "Old friend, that was not how I recalled it. Son," Madame interjected, "was interviewing us for his newspaper." "I'm the editor," he said, offering me his business card. "The interview will be on our first issue." The general, flush with good cheer, plucked a Chardonnay from the shelf. "Here is a token of appreciation for all your efforts in reviving the fine art of the Fourth Estate in our new land, my young friend." This could not help but prompt my memory of the journalist to whom we had given the gift of free room and board, albeit in a jail, for speaking a little too much truth to power. Perhaps Sonny was thinking the same thing, for he tried to decline the bottle, conceding only after much insistence from the general. I commemorated the occasion with Sonny's hulking Nikon, General and Madame flanking him while he cupped the bottle that the general grasped by the neck. "Slap that on your front page," the general said, by way of farewell. Left alone, Sonny and I traded brief synopses of our recent lives. He had decided to stay after graduation, knowing if he returned, he would likely receive a complimentary airplane ticket to the tranquil beaches and exclusive invitation-only prisons of Pulo Condor, built by the French with characteristic gusto. Before we refugees had arrived last year, Sonny had been reporting for an Orange County newspaper, making his home in a town I had never visited, Westminster, or, as our countrymen pronounced it, Wetminter. Moved by our refugee plight, he started up the first newspaper in our native tongue, an effort to tie us together with the news that binds. "But more later, my friend," he said, grasping me by the shoulder. "I have another appointment. Shall we meet for coffee? It does my heart good to see you again." Bemused, I agreed, giving him my number before he departed through the thinning crowd. I looked for the crapulent major, but he had disappeared. Except for him, most of our fellow exiles had been shrunken by the experience, either absolutely through the aforementioned maladies of migration, or relatively, surrounded by Americans so tall they neither looked through nor looked down on these newcomers. They simply looked over them. For Sonny, it was the opposite. He could not be ignored, but for different reasons from those in the past in our college days. I could not remember him being as gentle or generous then, but he pounded on tables and ranted the way the Vietnamese foreign student in Paris in the 20s and 30s must have done, the original crop of communists to lead our revolution. I, too, differed in behavior now, although how so was subject to the vagaries of my memory. The historical record had been expunged, for while I kept journals as a student, I had burned them all before returning, fearing to bring with me any incriminating traces of what I really thought. I breakfasted with the crapulent major a week later. It was an earthy, quotidian scene, the kind Walt Whitman would have loved to write about. A sketch of the new America, featuring hot rice porridge and fried crullers at a Monterey Park noodle shop crammed full of unrepentantly unassimilated Chinese and a few other assorted Asians. Grease glazed the orange formica tabletop, while chrysanthemum tea stood ready to be poured from a tin pot into chipped teacups the color and texture of the enamel on human teeth. I supped in a measured fashion, while the major gorged with the undisciplined enthusiasm of a man enamored with food, mouth open and talking simultaneously, the occasional fleck of spit or rice landing on my cheek, my eyelash or my own bowl. Eating with such relish, I could not help but love and pity the man in his innocence. This an informant? Hard to believe. But then he might be such a sly character as to be the perfect plant. The more logical conclusion was that the general had bolstered the Vietnamese tendency for conspiracy with the American trait of paranoia, admittedly with my help.
Never had the crapulent major exhibited any particular skill at deceit, covert maneuvering, or politicking. Back in Saigon, his function in the special branch had been to analyze Chinese language communication and to keep track of the subterranean subterfuges of Cholon, where the National Liberation Front had constructed an underground network for political agitation, terrorist organizing, and black market smuggling. More important, he was my source for the best Chinese food in Cholon. From majestic palaces with spectacular wedding banquets, to rattling carts roaming the unpaved streets, to elusive ladies who carried their bouncing wares on a yoke across their shoulders and set up shop on the sidewalks. Likewise in California, he had promised me the best rice porridge in Greater Los Angeles, and it was over a silky smooth white potage that I commiserated with the crapulent major. He was now a gas station attendant in Monterey Park, paid in cash so he could qualify for welfare benefits. His wife, sewing in a sweatshop, was already reduced to nearsightedness from staring so intently at the puzzle of cheap stitching. "My God, she can talk," he moaned, hunched over his empty bowl with the reproachful countenance of an unfed dog, eyeing my uneaten cruller. "She blames me for everything. Why didn't we stay at home? What are we doing here, where we're poorer than before? Why do we have kids we can't afford to feed? I forgot to tell you, Captain, my wife got pregnant in Kent. Twins, can you believe it?" Heart overcast but voice bright, I congratulated him. He appreciated the offer of my untouched cruller. "At least they're American citizens," he said, chewing on his doughy treat. "Spinach and broccoli. Those are their American names. To tell you the truth, we hadn't even thought about giving them American names until the nurse asked. I panicked. Of course they needed American names. The first thing that comes to mind is spinach."
I used to laugh at those cartoons, where Popeye ate his spinach and became super powerful all at once.
No one will mess with a kid named Spinach. As for broccoli, it just came logically. A lady on television said, "Always eat your broccoli," and I remembered that. A healthy food, not like what I eat. Strong and healthy, that's what these twins will be. They'll need to be. This country isn't for the weak or the fat. I need to go on a diet. No, I do. You're too kind. I'm quite aware I'm fat. The only good thing about being fat, besides the eating, is that everyone loves a fat man. Yes? Yes, people love to laugh at fat men and pity them, too. When I applied at that gas station, I was sweating even though I had walked just a couple of blocks. People look at a fat man sweating, and they feel sorry for him, even if they feel a little contempt, too. Then I smiled and shook my belly and laughed as I told my story about how I needed a job, and the owner gave it to me on the spot. All he needed was a reason to hire me. Making people laugh and feel sorry always does the trick. See? You're smiling right now and feeling sorry for me. Don't feel too sorry. I have a good shift. In at 10 in the morning and out by 8, 7 days a week, and I can walk to work from home. I don't do a thing except punch buttons on the cash register. It's great. Come by and I'll give you some free gallons. I insist. It's the least I can do for you helping us escape. I never did properly thank you. Besides, this is a tough country. We Vietnamese have to stick together. Oh, poor crapulent major. That night at home, I watched Bond clean and oil the .38 special on the coffee table, then loaded with 6 copper bullets, and lay it on the little throw pillow that came with our sofa, a tawdry, stained, red velour cushion on which the pistol rested like a gift to deposed royalty. "I'll shoot him through the pillow," Bond said, cracking open a beer. "Reduce noise." "Great," I said. Richard Head was being interviewed on television about the situation in Cambodia, his English accent a stark contrast to the interviewer's Bostonian one. After a minute of watching this, I said, "What if he's not a spy? We'll be killing the wrong man. Then it would be murder." Bond sipped his beer. "First," he said, "the general knows stuff we don't. Second, we're not killing. This is an assassination. You guys did this all the time. Third, this is war. Innocent people get killed. It's only murder if you know they're innocent. Even so, that's a tragedy, not a crime." "You were happy when the general asked you to do this, weren't you?" "Is that bad?" he said. He put the beer down and picked up the .38. As some men were born to handle a paintbrush or a pen,
He was born to wield a gun. It looked natural in his hand, a tool of which a man could be proud, like a wrench. A man needs a purpose, he said, contemplating the gun. Before I met Lin, I had purpose. I wanted revenge for my father. Then I fell in love, and Lin became more important than my father or revenge. I hadn't cried since he died, but after my marriage, I cried at his grave because I had betrayed him where it mattered the most, in my heart. I didn't get over that until Duke was born. At first, he was just this strange, ugly little thing. I wondered what was wrong with me, why I didn't love my own son. But slowly, he grew and grew, and one night, I noticed how his fingers and toes, his hands and feet, were perfectly made, miniature versions of mine. For the first time in my life, I knew what it was to be struck by wonder. Even falling in love was not like that feeling, and I knew that this was how my father must have looked at me. He had created me, and I had created Duke. It was nature, the universe, God, flowing through us. That was when I fell in love with my son, when I understood how insignificant I was, and how marvelous he was, and how one day he'd feel the exact same thing. And it was then I knew I hadn't betrayed my father. I cried again, holding my boy, because I'd finally become a man. What I'm saying, why I'm telling you all this, is that my life once had meaning. It had purpose. Now it has none. I was a son and a husband and a father and a soldier, and now I'm none of that. I'm not a man, and when a man isn't a man, he's nobody. And the only way not to be nobody is to do something. So I can either kill myself or kill someone else. Get it? I not only got it, I was astonished. It was the longest speech I had ever heard from him, his sorrow and rage and despair, not only cracking open his heart, but loosening his vocal cords. Those words even succeeded in making him less ugly than he objectively was, if not handsome, emotion softening the hard features of his face. He was the only man I had ever met who seemed moved deeply, not only by love, but also by the prospect of killing. While he was an expert by necessity, I was a novice by choice, despite having had my opportunities. In our country, killing a man, or a woman, or a child, was as easy as turning a page of the morning paper. One only needed an excuse and an instrument, and too many on all sides possessed both. What I did not have was the desire or the various uniforms of justification a man dons as camouflage, the need to defend God, country, honor, ideology, or comrades, even if, in the last instance, all he really is protecting is that most tender part of himself, the hidden, wrinkled purse carried by every man. These off-the-rack excuses fit some people well, but not me. I wanted to persuade the general that the crapulent major was no spy, but it would hardly do to disinfect him of the idea with which I had infected him in the first place. More than this, I knew I had to prove to the general that I could correct my ostensible mistake, and that I could be a man of action. Not doing something was not an option, as the general's demeanor made clear to me at our next meeting the following week. "He deserves it," the general said, disagreeably obsessed with the indelible stain of guilt he saw stamped on the major's forehead, that tiny handprint of the major's doomed mortality left there by me. "But take your time. I am in no rush. Operations should be performed patiently and painstakingly." He affirmed this in a storeroom that channeled the dispassionate atmosphere of a war room, the walls newly decorated with maps showing our sinuous, narrow-waisted homeland in all its splendor, or its parts, each suffocating behind plastic sheeting, red markers dangling on strings next to them. "Better to do it well and slowly than quickly and poorly," he said. "Yes, sir," I said. What I had in mind was no need to bore me with details. Just let me know when it's done. So the major's demise was written. Nothing was left me but to create a believable story where his death was neither my fault nor the general's. I did not have to think very hard before the most obvious story came to me. What we had here was your usual American tragedy, only this time starring a hapless refugee. Professor Hammer invited me to dinner the next Saturday night at his house, the occasion being Claude's imminent return to Washington. The only other guest was the professor's boyfriend, Stan, a doctoral student my own age at UCLA, writing his dissertation on the American literary expatriates of Paris. He had the white teeth and blonde hair of a model in a toothpaste ad, where his role would be the young father of toothsome cherubs. The professor's homosexuality had been mentioned to me by Claude before I matriculated at the college in 63, because, Claude said, I just didn't want you to be surprised. Never having known a homosexual, I had been curious to see how one behaved in his natural environment, which is to say, the West, as the East, apparently, had no homosexuals. Much to my disappointment, Professor Hammer seemed no different from anyone else, aside from his acute intelligence and impeccable taste in all things, extending to Stan and the culinary arts. The three-course meal was prepared by the professor himself, a salad of mixed greens, duck confit with rosemary potatoes, and a flaky tarte tatin, preceded by martinis, accompanied by Pinot Noir, and finished off with a single malt scotch. All was served in the meticulously restored dining room of the professor's craftsman bungalow in Pasadena, everything from the double-hung windows to the Art Deco chandelier to the brass hardware of the built-in cabinetry, either an original from the early 20th century or a faithful reproduction. Every now and then the professor rose from the dining table and replaced the record on the turntable, choosing a new selection from his extensive jazz collection. Over dinner, we talked about Bebop, the 19th-century novel, The Dodgers, and America's upcoming bicentennial. Then we repaired with our scotch to the living room with its massive fireplace of river rock and its stately mission furniture of angular wooden frames and leather cushions. Books of all heights, widths, and colors lined the walls in a democratic parade of individualism, arranged as haphazardly as they were on the walls of the professor's campus office. Ensconced thus by letters, words, sentences, paragraphs, pages, chapters, and tomes, the evening was a pleasant one, memorable for the exchange that took place after we assumed our seats. His nostalgia stimulated, perhaps by the literature around him, the professor said, "I still remember your thesis on the Quiet American. That was one of the best undergraduate theses I've ever read." I smiled demurely and said, "Thanks," while Claude, sitting beside me on the sofa, snorted. I didn't care too much for that book. The Vietnamese girl, all she does is prepare opium, read picture books, and twitter like a bird. Have you ever met a Vietnamese girl like her? If so, please introduce me. All the ones I meet can't keep their mouths shut in or out of bed. "Oh, Claude," the professor said. "Oh, Claude, nothing. No offense, Avery, but our American friend in that book also happens to look suspiciously like a latent homosexual." "Takes one to smell one," Stan said. "Who wrote that one for you, Noel Coward? His name is Pyle, for God's sake. How many jokes can you make with that name? It's also a pro-communist book, or at least anti-American. Same thing, anyway." Claude waved his hand at the books, the furniture, the living room, presumably the whole well-appointed home. "Hard to believe he was once a communist, isn't it?" "Stan?" I said. "No, not Stan. Were you Stan?" "I thought not." That left the professor, who shrugged his shoulders when I looked at him. "I was your age," he said, putting his arm around Stan's shoulders. "I was impressionable. I was passionate. I wanted to change the world. Communism seduced me like so many others." "Now he's the one doing the seducing," Stan said, squeezing the professor's hand, a sight that made me squirm just a little. For me, the professor was a walking mind, and to see him as a body, or having a body, was still discomforting. "Do you ever regret being a communist, professor?" "No, I do not. Only by making that mistake could I be what I am today." "What is that, sir?" He smiled. "I suppose you could call me a born-again American." An irony, but if the bloody history of the past few decades has taught me anything, it's that the defense of freedom demands the muscularity only America can provide.
Even what we do at the college has its purpose. We teach you the best of what was thought and said, not only to explain America to the world, as I have always encouraged you to do, but to defend it. I sipped my scotch. It was smoky and smooth, tasting of peat and aged oak, underscored by licorice and the intangible essence of Scottish masculinity. I like my scotch undiluted, like I like my truth. Unfortunately, undiluted truth was as affordable as 18-year-old single malt scotch. What about those who have not learned the best of what was thought and said, I asked the professor, if we can't teach them or if they won't be taught? The professor contemplated the copper depths of his drink. I suppose you and Claude have seen more than your fair share of those types in your line of work. There's no easy answer, except to say it has always been thus. Ever since the first caveman discovered fire and decided that the ones still living in darkness were benighted, it's been civilization against barbarism, with every age having its own barbarians. Nothing was more clear-cut than civilization versus barbarism, but what was the killing of the crapulent major? A simple act of barbarism, or a complex one that advanced revolutionary civilization? It had to be the latter, a contradictory act that suited our age. We Marxists believe that capitalism generates contradictions and will fall apart from them, but only if men take action. But it was not just capitalism that was contradictory. As Hegel said, tragedy was not the conflict between right and wrong, but right and right. A dilemma none of us who wanted to participate in history could escape. The major had the right to live, but I was right to kill him, wasn't I? When Claude and I left near midnight, I came as close as I could to broaching the subject of my conscience with him. As we smoked farewell cigarettes on the sidewalk, I asked a question that I imagined my mother asking of me. What if he's innocent? He blew a smoke ring, just to show he could. No one's innocent, especially in this business. You don't think he might have some blood on his hand? He identified Viet Cong sympathizers. He might have gotten the wrong man. It's happened before. Or if he himself is a sympathizer, then he definitely identified the wrong people, on purpose. I don't know any of that for sure. Innocence and guilt, these are comic issues. We're all innocent on one level and guilty on another. Isn't that what original sin is all about? True enough, I said. I let him go with a handshake. The airing of moral doubts was as tiresome as the airing of domestic squabbles. No one really interested except for the ones directly involved. In this situation, I was clearly the only one involved, except for the crapulent major, and no one cared to hear his opinion. Claude, meanwhile, had offered me absolution, or at least an excuse, but I did not have the heart to tell him I could not use it. Original sin was simply too unoriginal for someone like me, born from a father who spoke of it at every mass. The next evening, I began reconnoitering the major. On that Sunday and the following five, from May until the end of June, I parked my car half a block from the gas station, waiting for 8 o'clock when the crapulent major would leave, walking slowly home, lunchbox in hand. When I saw him turn the corner, I started the car and drove it to the corner, where I waited and watched him walk down the first block. He lived 3 blocks away, a distance a thin, healthy man could walk briskly in 5 minutes. It took the crapulent major approximately 11, with myself always at least a block behind. During 6 Sundays, he never varied his routine, faithful as a migratory mallard, his route taking him through a neighborhood of apartments that all seemed to be dying of boredom. The major's own diminutive quadruplex was fronted by a carport with 4 slots, one vacant and 3 occupied by cars with the dented, drooping posteriors of elderly bus drivers. An overhanging second floor, its 2 sets of windows looking onto the street, shaded the cars. At 8:11 in the evening or so, the morose eyes of those bedroom windows were open but curtained, only one of them lit. On the first 2 Sundays, I parked at the corner and watched as he turned into the carport and vanished. On the 3rd and 4th Sundays, I did not follow him from the gas station, but waited for him a half a block past his apartment. From there, I watched in my mirror as he entered the carport's shadowed margin, a lane leading to the bottom apartments. As soon as he disappeared those first four Sundays, I went home. But on the fifth and sixth Sundays, I waited. Not until 10 o'clock did the car that parked in the vacant spot appear. As aged and dinged as the others, the driver, a tired-looking Chinese man wearing a smeared chef's smock and carrying a greasy paper bag. On the Sunday before our appointment with the crapulent major, Bon and I drove to Chinatown. In an alley off Broadway, lined with vendors selling wares from folding tables, we bought UCLA sweatshirts and baseball caps at prices that guaranteed they were not official merchandise. After a lunch of barbecued pork and noodles, we browsed one of the curio shops where all manner of orientalia was sold, primarily to the non-oriental. Chinese chess sets, wooden chopsticks, paper lanterns, soapstone Buddhas, miniature water fountains, elephant tusks with elaborate carvings of pastoral scenes, reproductions of Ming vases, coasters with images of the Forbidden City, rubber nunchaku bundled with posters of Bruce Lee, scrolls with watercolor paintings of cloud-draped mountain forests, tins of tea and ginseng, and, neither last nor least, red firecrackers. I bought two packets and, before we returned home, a mesh sack of oranges from a local market, their navels protruding indecently. Later that evening, after dark, Bon and I ventured out one more time, each of us with a screwdriver. We toured the neighborhood until we reached an apartment with a carport like the crapulent major's. The car is not visible from any neighboring windows. It took less than 30 seconds for Bon to remove the front license plate from one car and myself the plate from the rear. Then we went home and watched television until bedtime. Bon fell asleep immediately, but I could not. Our visit to Chinatown reminded me of an incident that had taken place in Cholon years before with the crapulent major and myself. The occasion was the arrest of a Viet Cong suspect who had graduated from the top of our gray list to the bottom of our black list. Enough people had fingered this person as a Viet Cong for us to neutralize him, or so the major said, showing me the thick dossier he had compiled. Official occupation, rice wine merchant. Black market occupation, casino operator. Hobby, Viet Cong tax collector. We cordoned off the ward with roadblocks on all streets and foot patrols in the alleys. While the secondary units did ID checks in the neighborhood, fishing for draft dodgers, the major's men entered the rice wine merchant's shop, pushed past his wife to reach the storeroom, and found the lever that opened a secret door. Gamblers were shooting craps and playing cards, their rice wine and hot soup served for free by waitresses in outrageous outfits. On seeing our policemen charging through the door, all the players and employees promptly dashed for the rear exit, only to find another squad of heavies waiting outside. The usual hijinks and hilarity ensued, involving much screaming, shrieking, billy clubs, and handcuffs, until, at last, it was only the crapulent major, myself, and our suspect, whom I was surprised to see. I had tipped off Man about the raid and fully expected the tax collector to be absent. "VC," the man cried, waving his hand in the air. "No way. I'm a businessman." "A very good one, too," the major said, hefting a garbage bag filled with the casino's cash. "So you got me there," the man said, miserable. He had an overbite and three long, lucky hairs sprouting from a mole the size of a marble on his cheek. "Okay, take the money. It's yours. I'm happy to contribute to the cause of the police." "That's offensive," the major said, poking the man's gut with his billy club. "This is going to the government to pay your fines and back taxes, not to us. Right, Captain?" "Right," I said, the straight man in this routine. "But as to future taxes, that's a different matter. Right, Captain?" "Right." There was nothing I could do for the tax collector. He spent a week in the interrogation center being beaten black and blue, as well as red and yellow. By the end, our men were convinced that he was not a VC operative. The proof was incontrovertible. Arriving in the form of a sizable bribe, the man's wife brought to the crapulent major. "I guess I was mistaken," he said cheerfully, handing me an envelope with my share. It was equivalent to a year's salary, which, to put it into perspective, was actually not enough to live on for a year. Refusing the money would have aroused suspicion, so I took it. I was tempted to use it for charitable activity, namely the support of beautiful young women hampered by poverty, but I remembered what my father said, rather than what he did, as well as Ho Chi Minh's adages. Both Jesus and Uncle Ho were clear that money was corrupting, from the moneylenders desecrating the temple.